Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations. Ante Up, it's your poker magazine.
From the Ante Up headquarters in Tampa Bay, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now, here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's May 29th, 2020. You're listening to the best PokerCast on the internet. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
Things are looking up, or what do you think?
They're not looking down. Let's say that. Every day we're hearing more casinos opening and more of them opening with poker rooms. Obviously, it's still the lion's share of casinos are reopening without poker, so that hasn't changed too much. But there's more. I mean, I think last week we counted 25 rooms. I didn't do a count today, but we're definitely above 30 poker rooms, I think, that will be open by the end of this weekend, if not more.
Yeah.
And then, obviously, as we'll mention here in the first item, Nevada's opening on June 4th, so we'll see what that means. But
any news on the petition? They were petitioning for 6-hand instead of 4.
Which will make a big difference.
Yeah. So. I don't know if there's any news on that, though. Nothing's moved forward on that. Have you heard anything? I haven't read anything on that.
Anything definitive on that.
Yeah, so. I didn't see anything either as of this morning, so I wasn't sure if you did that I didn't see. But okay, go ahead.
All right, well, here are this week's updates. Thunder Valley Casino Resort in California will reopen June 8th with reduced capacity poker. We've heard since it'll be 7-handed there. And also, while we don't have an official statement to share yet, this year's Ante Up World Championship at Thunder Valley has been postponed to the summer of 2021. Casinos in Nevada are permitted to reopen June 4th, as we mentioned, though with poker limited to a maximum of 4 players, pending any change in that. Venetian Las Vegas is one that says it will open with poker. In Florida, Cala Gainesville Poker, Daytona Beach Racing and Card Club, Orange City Racing and Card Club, and Naples Fort Myers Greyhound Track are the latest poker rooms to reopen, with the TGT Poker here in Tampa slated to join them on June 1st. Kansas casinos have reopened, but none of them with poker so far. Tribal casinos in Michigan will be reopening over the next couple weeks, but none have said they will reopen their poker room when the casino reopens. Delaware casinos can reopen on June 1st, but neither that offer poker have said they will offer it on June 1st. Minnesota tribal casinos are reopening June 1st as well, but none will offer poker initially. West Virginia casinos can reopen on June 5th, but without poker. And no date has been announced for when Pennsylvania poker rooms may reopen. However, the state's gaming control board says poker will not be permitted right away. And poker rooms that have reopened are reporting robust business with long wait lists. And then a reminder, the Ante Up has started a reopen webpage at anteupmagazine.com/reopen, listing verified details on casino and poker room openings. And if you have any updates for us, email us at editor@anteupmagazine.com.
And quite a few of our listeners have actually emailed us and said, hey, Here's what's going on. We were so appreciative of that. You know, here's what's going on here that I learned. And then the little rumor mill, too, was going on, which is always interesting because rumors sometimes have a kernel of truth, and then you could sort of dig in and find some more information. So we appreciate anyone who's been emailing us with that stuff. It's great to put some news on the site and to get a little more hope out there for us. So thanks for doing that.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, it's particularly going to be helpful going forward. I mean, right now we're waiting for casinos to open. That's a little bit easier because normally we'll get, you know, a news report saying a particular state has allowed casinos to reopen. So then we can focus our efforts on, you know, scrolling the various websites and Facebook pages of those casinos to get their information. But once they reopen and they reopen without poker initially, that's where it gets challenging because, you know, it's already hard enough. I will tell you, as someone spends hours a day trying to keep up to date on all this to go back over casinos that, haven't reopened yet to find out the deals, but then they go back and look at upwards of 200 to find out if they have now reopened poker, which is going to be harder to figure out on Facebook pages and websites, I think. Because all these casinos, at least most of them, are putting out reopening plans right on the website. So it's a big document that explains, you know, how well they've cleaned everything, how well they're going to continue cleaning things, you know, whether they're going to check your temperatures or make you wear a mask, what's open now, what's not open now. So that's pretty easy. I mean, it takes a while to dig through before you get to the eventual poker is not included in phase one part of all the reopenings, right? But then when poker reopens after that is going to be the harder thing, I think, for us to figure out. So certainly we would appreciate any new sleuths out there that are feeding us tips. But particularly going forward for casinos that are open now or reopening soon but without poker, when you hear that poker is going to be added, that is going to be super helpful to us if you let us know.
Absolutely. So I have a question for you. There are a couple of the rooms that I read were actually just doing regular full tables, don't even. Yep. And then I thought to myself, okay, so are we like, hey, kudos to you for, you know what, recognizing that all this is just window dressing, screw it, we're just going to go back to it because I know this other crap's not going to help. Or do we say, oh, this is so reckless, you know, we shouldn't be doing this. And I don't know. I think it's probably the right thing to do. If you're going to catch it four-handed, you're going to catch it nine-handed. I don't see if you catch it nine-handed, you're not going to catch it four-handed because you're at an eight-foot table. So why not just make it seven or eight-handed, right?
Yeah, I think that's the key point of what you're saying is that I think there's a reasonable and rational debate to have over whether poker should be open or not.
Yeah.
But once you get into two players, four players, seven players, nine players, at that point, that's just kind of academic at that point. You know, either it's open or it's not. So at that point, you know, it is a little surprising to me that there are poker rooms opening and reducing the number of players at the table. Not the tables and the distance between them, which, you know, kind of makes some sense. But it does seem that, you know, in for a dime, in for a dollar is a good old poker.
Right.
Kind of seems like it. I'm like, if you're going to offer poker, offer it. Now, a lot of it, a problem I think is guidance they're getting from, you know, casino. In some states, the Casino Gaming Commission is the one dictating all this stuff. It's not the casinos deciding, right? So at that point, you have to essentially do what your licensing board is telling you to do. But I'm also curious how those thoughts are going. I mean, it's the same with blackjack. You know, you only got three players at a blackjack table instead of the normal six. You know, I saw one yesterday where craps, all the players had to be 6 feet apart from each other. So essentially four players playing craps at a time.
Right.
And no blowing on the dice. So, you know, it's just, it is a weird, I mean, I guess we're going to keep talking about this week in and week out, but it's just a weird thing to be in where you have all this advice. Sometimes it's conflicting. So as a business, you're trying to reopen and do what you can to make that work. But then if you take a step back out of the realm of that and look at it, it does tend to look pretty ridiculous, right?
Yeah. It's a delicate balance too, because you want to make the players happy. And you want to have a business, but you don't want to piss off the players or the community, you know, by doing the wrong thing too soon or whatever. And it's very difficult. It's a difficult time for all of us. It really is.
Yeah, and again, you know, hey, I get you know, dinged for trying to be too optimistic, but I'll continue to allow myself to be dinged for that because, again, I think we should all be wanting to be optimistic that, you know, as stuff reopens, it proves that the stuff isn't spreading anymore, right? That's I think we should all want that. Whether how realistic it is, I don't know, but we should all want that. And then clearly, casinos are opening, so it is what it is. So I mean, folks that are concerned about it are not going to be returning, but it does look like they're not hurting for business. At least from the ones that I talked to that are open, they.
Right.
Hamul has said that it's been crazy busy there. I know Matt Savage tweeted out the wait list at Seminole Hard Rock here in Tampa were hours long. So, and there they had the plexiglass on the table, which, you know, I think we talked about last week. Some people were comparing it to jail and who would want to play there. Well, apparently tons of people.
Yeah, apparently tons of people.
So, you know, I guess we'll just have to wait and see. I would hope if we go here a couple months and there is no bigger outbreak, and certainly no big outbreak traced back to casinos, that maybe we can start reducing some of these arbitrary numbers that we're talking about that I think we all think is are arbitrary, and get back to what it is. But I don't know.
Yeah.
So Nevada and Vegas is really interesting, I think, you know, because, again, that's a gaming commission that's dictating the four players. That's not the individual casinos, right? So what the individual casinos have to decide is whether it's whether it makes sense to open four-handed or not. And as we mentioned, Venetian is one that I know is. I'm going to spend the rest of the day today trying to research the rest of Nevada casinos, so we'll have a better idea on our reopen website by tomorrow. Whether they do or not, but that seems to be a little bit easier of a choice, I think, if I'm a casino manager, right? It just doesn't seem like I want to open four-handed.
Yeah. Well, I know one of our ambassadors, Jen Gay, her husband was the director of poker for the New Sahara Room.
Right, yeah.
And as soon as they announced four-handed, she put out on social media, like, hey, is this even feasible? I mean, when you start thinking about it, how could they possibly think we're going to run a room this way? And I agree with her. It's so difficult. But if you're the only room in town who's willing to do this, you're going to get enough people.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
I think that's what we're seeing.
With Venetian.
Definitely in Humul and in San Diego. And I don't want to suggest it's not a great run room. It's a very, very well-run room. Our friends there take good care of their players. But, you know, they're the newest poker room there. And so they obviously were fighting to get traction before all this, but now they're the only one reopen there.
Yep.
And some of them I'm hearing are probably not going to reopen. And so, you know, I think it's a combination of it being a well-run room and being the only game in town that the reason that they're slammed there. So,
you know how the race to be first in like other businesses or what people will, all of a sudden they get brand recognition automatically or whatever it is. Same with these, you know, you get all these players going to your room who've never gone to your room before, and now you got a chance to impress them and show them how great it is there or how much they like your ambiance or whatever the hell it is, and you're going to win a bunch of poker players over. You're not going to lose any, you know? So yeah. They can see why they'd want to do it.
If you're running a good room, it's really hard for another room to drag players out of your room, right? Because, again, poker players are really on you know, if it's 1-3, no limit here or there or anywhere else, it's the same game, right? So it's where you feel most comfortable playing. So and once you get comfortable in a place, it's really hard for somebody else to come in and steal your from that casino unless you're given a reason to, right? So
right.
Yeah. What I think is interesting in Nevada, though, with the four-handed, I mean, already that's a tough sell, I think, the poker rooms to open four-handed. The other part of it makes it harder is that's one of the states where you can play online poker in, right?
Right.
So, you know, if you're like here in Florida and they said we're a real poker happy state because there's limited other gaming options here, and they dictated, we don't have a gaming commission here, but they dictated four-handed, I would say that every room here probably would open four-handed just because they know people are going to come out. Because they don't have online poker here. But if we had online poker in Florida, then I could see a bunch saying, you know, hey, I don't know.
Right.
That's harder to get. Well, I mean, there's a couple of challenges. You already got the challenge of the people who are concerned about the virus and aren't yet going out anywhere, right? Not to restaurants or poker or anything, right? So you're already missing those folks, and then the ones that are, you know, cautious about the precautions. You know, some people don't like wearing masks, don't want their temperature checked, or anything like that. Although that's been really interesting to watch. At least at the Hard Rock in Tampa, they scan 6 to 8 people at a time with their thermometers there.
Wow.
You know, I just off the top of my head, you know, just based on the Burger King commercial where they're taking the employee's temperature. I was just wondering how long it's going to take to get in some of these casinos if they zap you and then coming in. But the technology there, they've worked out. It's kind of like a mass sensor.
Wow.
And they can tell, you know, individually as you walk through the turnstile, whether your temperature is higher or not. And then, you know, then you have to get a second test if it is. But so it's slow like that, that, I mean, in your mind, you're thinking it's operating one way, but until you see it and you see it's operating differently, that might make you not want to go, right?
Yeah.
Now make you want to go. So, we'll see. I mean, forehand, it's going to be tough. But I think you're right. If Venetian's the only room in Vegas dealing poker forehanded, there's going to be a lot of people that are playing forehanded.
Yeah.
And I've seen some articles where some pros are talking about how people need to learn to play shorthanded, so maybe this is a good thing. I don't know if I necessarily agree with that. I think that's a pro's perspective on taking advantage of fish that aren't going to be able to adjust to shorthanded, but I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah.
So the other thing was interesting, and I was going to put it as a separate item, but and we didn't talk about it last week because it came out last week right before the show, was that the CDC revising its guidance on how likely you are to contract COVID from surfaces.
Right.
Which I think was a pretty big deal, particularly when we're talking about poker, right? You know, I talked to some managers, they talk about the plexiglass dividers that some of these rooms are doing. There's a little like chuckle over that, because, you know, they're like, hey, it's the touching of the cards and the chips that are a big deal, which a normal transmission is, right? So if the CDC now says, hey, as long as you know, don't touch your hands and face after touching stuff and you sanitize, it's a much less deal than, obviously, you don't want to be spit on or sneezed on, right?
right.
So then it made me kind of wonder if that makes a difference. But then it sounds like CDC now is waffling on the actual wording of that. So that's why I didn't put it on as an actual item to talk about today. So we'll kind of see how that develops. But if that ends up really being their guidance, I think that's going to encourage some more folks to come out and not be as worried as they were. Or if they change it back, then that will keep more people out of the program, I think. So.
Yeah, I mean, that's huge, because now the actual plexiglass is like the only thing that is working, is to be the thing that's going to keep you from actually getting it, because the cars and the chips, if that's indeed not a way you're going to get it, that'd be fantastic, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, then they're like, okay, well, I'm protected by this, plus I got a mask on top of it, you know? That will embolden people if they're convinced that touching stuff isn't going to do it. If you're wearing a mask and you're not touching your face and putting your fingers in your eyes and stuff, you know, I mean, obviously, if somebody sneezes and their sputum lands on a chip and you grab the chip and you put it on your index finger and you wipe your eye, you're going to get it.
Yeah.
But I mean, basically, if you're careful, you know, this is going to embolden people if they stick to this. So that's good. Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. I was meaning to say something to you about that, and I forgot, so I'm glad you said
that. Yeah, but it's interesting, because then I saw an article yesterday when I was putting the show note together that said the CDC had revised that language because they didn't like how the media had reported it, which is, again, it's kind of the problem with all this guidance, right?
Yes.
It's all kind of a puddle of mud, right? So it goes back to my favorite phrase through all this is confirmation bias. You know, whatever your mind says you want to believe, you will find it in COVID somewhere. You will find a doctor who says what you believe, and your friend will find a doctor who says what he believes. And that's why it's so frustrating and all this.
Just like religion.
Yeah.
And the Bible.
Like, to be honest.
Go into that Bible and find what you want. I'm sorry. I'm getting political. That's not political. I'm getting religious. Sorry.
Oh, man. Yeah, so I mean, but I do think that's kind of a bigger deal. I mean, so the other thing we haven't talked about that I'm waiting for this to happen. I mean, I'm not waiting for it to happen. I hope it doesn't, but you know it will. I mean, what happens when somebody has a huge sneezing attack at one of these plexiglass tables?
Yeah.
I mean, obviously they're going to remove them and then squeegee it down and stuff, right? But as a player at the table, we witness that. Is that going to make you feel like staying at the table, or maybe it's time to rack up and go home?
I don't know. And that's the other thing too, is people are saying you don't have to wear your masks in some of these places as long as you're at one of those tables. Because I've seen photos of a local poker room here that was in a local newspaper that had plexiglass up, and they didn't have their masks on while they were looking at their cards and playing. And there's numerous photos of them doing that. So yeah, if they have a sneezing fit, what's hilarious is people think that the glass is the difference. I mean, it helps if you're at a table with a mask on, but you know, that stuff gets into the air ducts, and or there's a fan in the room and it's circling around.
I mean yeah, you'll see the snot dripping down from it, but it's the stuff that's sprayed in the air, right?
Right, exactly. It's the droplets
floating around. So, but I just think it's more, it's, I'm like, I mean, even when they come over and squeegee it down, you're going to sit there and I'm like, God, somebody just fucked a loogie all over that thing, right? And
yeah.
And then, what if you're the next guy to sit down?
Yeah.
Hey, I hope you don't spit all over the plexiglass like the guy right before you. Okay, thank you. Table change.
I mean, I don't know about you, but your mind now, mine at least, when I went to go see my mom the other day because my mom's not doing well. My mom's been in and out of the hospital a bunch the last month. I've been really going crazy. And so finally she's home. And so we're all wearing masks and we're all far away from her, you know, good 10, 12 feet or whatever. Yeah. But when I was walking up to the door, my brother was sitting on the love seat and he got up and went over to the other side of the room because they're all quarantined together up there. And when I walked in, I'm like, I just sat where my brother was sitting. And I thought, it's not a big deal because he's quarantined. He doesn't have it. He's been quarantined for months. If he was asymptomatic, he would have given it to somebody up there. They're not all asymptomatic. So I wasn't really worried, but I thought, in the back of my head, I just thought, wow, I'm seated now where my brother was sitting. And he could have had it on his hands, and now I've touched it. Now it's on my hands, and then I can't rub my eyes. And so you think that way. So imagine sitting down at a table, and if they're not – I'm assuming, though, most of these places are like when a player gets up, somebody comes over and cleans.
Oh, yeah. I think all of them have said that.
But someone's still going to say something to you. You know, hey, the guy who was there was just hacking up a lung.
Poker players are, right? They're not going to be able to stop themselves from saying, oh, my God. Hope you don't have the COVID like the guy right before you.
Throw him off his game, right?
Yeah.
Now you're playing mind games with the guy. Well, we'll see.
Yeah, it's we'll see is like the best word right now. Yeah. I mean, because none of us know where this is going. And so we definitely will see what it all means in the next couple months. So, all right, if you're going to accuse poker players of cheating, you might not want to do it the way Bill Perkins did Saturday night. The pro tweeted that night about a cheating scandal that would make the, quote, Mike Postle case look like a church service, adding that some of the people involved he considered poker heroes, but one of them did the right thing. But Perkins shared no specifics. A day later, he tweeted again, saying the scandal happened in a private poker app and involved players using fish accounts, and that one player had confessed. Again, no specifics. Twitterverse didn't take kindly to the vagueness and responded with speculation over who might be involved, as well as condemnation for Perkins' vagueness. And then it got weird, Chris. And then it got weird, right?
Right, exactly.
Dan Bilzerian tweeted that a player had Dan Jungleman Dan Cates play on that player's account, prompting Cates to tweet his own cryptic tweet saying he was prevented by legal reasons from fully discussing the allegation, but that he has never played against Bilzerian. I my mind is just scrambled. Right?
This is crazy. Where do you even begin?
Well, I'll begin. I don't think I've ever said this on the show, but I hate Twitter.
Oh, no. You really do? We should shut it down. That's it. We're shutting it down. Executive order.
Oh, man. But this is really one more reason than the 5 million that I have that why I hate Twitter. But yeah, I mean, I don't even know where you go with this. It's just, it's so crazy on so many levels.
Well, how does this change just because it's Twitter? He could still do it on Facebook or anywhere else. He could still go on Facebook and say the same thing.
It's a little different. One, it's, I mean, you're using real names on Facebook for the most part. That's always been my big criticism between the two. The second is you can be more verbose on Facebook, so you can actually explain yourself a little bit more than the, I think it's, what, 280 characters
now. Yeah, but you keep forgetting that people, they want to say what they want to say on there. All they do is they type it up on something, do a screen grab, and then attach it to the Twitter thing and write as much as they want. So.
No, but it's still, it's harder to do, and it makes it a little bit more confusing. But I also think that people are more, this kind of, they're more likely, and I'm open to debate on this, they're more likely to share this kind of quote-unquote news on Twitter than they are on Facebook, and it spreads faster on Twitter. It's like COVID. Twitter's the COVID of social media.
Nice.
But anyhow, I mean, okay, I should have written down a list of things that about this that are just crazy. One, I hate when people accuse people of doing anything without any facts. Not just poker, but anything, right?
Yeah.
So that's kind of a problem. I do like that Mike Posse case looked like a church service. That was a nice turn of phrase there. But and then he eventually had to, I don't know if he apologized. That might be a big word to say, but
walk it back.
That he probably overstated, which was a lot of the criticism. So I don't like that. I don't like this. Hey, one guy did the right thing because he had the opportunity to cheat and decided not to. I mean, I guess I would rather that person do that than have the opportunity to cheat and cheat. But
yeah.
It doesn't seem like a ringing endorsement, right? This guy is great because he was presented the opportunity to cheat and he said, you know what, maybe I won't today. I'll pass. And then this whole world, I think this is when I try to explain poker to my friends that don't play. Because they see pros on TV, right?
Right.
Is that it's just, that's a whole different universe than the poker that you and I know, right?
Yeah.
You know, going to Derby Lane to play a card, having a home game, that's one level of poker that we can understand. The pros and where they operate and all this is just, it's a fantasy land from the beginning to the end. And I'm not just talking about open face Chinese. Like, it's... I mean, like, so they have these private poker apps, and then they're talking about the fish accounts, and then one of the criticisms of the bill was, like, everybody knows everybody uses fish accounts. I'm like, what? What? Like, 30 seconds ago, I didn't even know what a fish account was. Now you're telling me that everybody knows about it and everybody uses it and no one cares? So they got that, and then, of course, I knew Dan Bilzerian would find a way to be involved in this somehow, so... So one, I don't like that he outed somebody again without any proof, which is frustrating. But then the response from the person he outed was to say that you can't say, I can't explain myself for legal reasons.
Yeah.
That's a little weird too, isn't it?
Well, if there is some sort of lawsuit that's pending that we don't know about that could be privately, hasn't been dug up yet by Doug Jones or whoever these guys are that are doing all this hard journalism and poker cheating, but yeah, I know it is. It just opens up more can of worms. Now you know people are going to start investigating to try to find out what the hell he's talking about.
Yeah,
just get.
I mean, it was like the best thing to happen to Mike Posse.
To quote Scott Long, it's the wild, wild west out there in online poker, and you'd be wise to be careful. Now that's one thing I think. These fish accounts and all this stuff would go away if they had regulation. I think if the U.S. government got involved, they would make sure that one account and one IP, one address or whatever, you'd have to prove who you were and all this stuff. And I don't know. I mean, maybe they could still find a way around it, but I think they would work toward trying to eliminate
it.
Yeah, it'd be
hard. I mean, to loop this back to COVID, which is the only thing we ever talk about, right, is, you know, all this stuff can't be prevented, but you can do things to make it less likely, right? So, you know, you can't prevent COVID from getting COVID, but you can wear a mask, you can social distance, you can not leave your house, you can do all this stuff to make sure you don't, right? So same with, you know, if you don't want to get cheated on a poker app, the best way of not getting cheated on a poker app is not to play poker on a poker app, right? But, you know, again, it's the whole risk averse and risk calculations that we do in daily life and in poker all the time. So, you know, you make that decision that, hey, I'm making enough money on this poker app that I'm willing to accept the risk that the guy I'm playing against may not be the guy who I think I'm playing against, but I'm playing against somebody much better.
Yeah. I mean, again, there's nothing anyone could do. Let's say I was a superior poker player to you, which I guess I am. And then you said, hey, I really want to make a lot of money on my account, or I want to beat this guy that I've been playing every night, and I can't beat him, but I know you can. Come over to my house and play as me. There's nothing they can do to stop that. There's just nothing they could do. They right. might look at your play habits and say, oh, you're playing differently. I don't think it's you. But there's the only way outside of having a camera in the house filming you doing it, you know, there's no way they could actually stop someone from doing it. So that's maybe the only thing that they couldn't stop. But the other stuff they could pretty much figure out one way or another to at least eliminate a lot of the stuff that goes on behind the scenes.
Yeah, absolutely. But even playing on a fish account, that's what's curious about it. I mean, is that the cheating that's going on? Because some people would say that's cheating, and some people would say that's not.
I would say it's misrepresentation, but I don't know about cheating. But yeah.
The semantics.
Exactly.
But I wonder if it's something more than that. If it's something more than that, that's a bigger deal, I think. But yeah. Who knows? It's so weird. It's the world that these people are in that just so removed from the rest of the world. Like, you know, like our Tampa Bay Rays pitcher Blake Snell complaining about not getting paid this year. Looking at that guy, and I'm like, come on, dude. Go back and play your video games. Like, you're going to be all right.
And they're still arguing about that. I don't want to get into this, Trav. This not. But is it any wonder why we focused our magazine on everyday players?
Yes, exactly. Right. It's a little less crazy than the Biggie Goose. But
time for Annie updates. The Papes, the Annie Up Fans Online Play Money Tournament Series on PokerStars Play Money site, is available everywhere. Details on how to join can be found at bit.ly/papes, PAIPS. Games are on the 6th, 16th, and 26th of every month and rotate disciplines with a main tournament followed by a second chance event. Join the Antiup Fans Group Facebook page and post within the group to get feedback on hands, ask Cole the 4 questions, or just discuss anything poker. Also, you can check out our 11 vintage Antiup logo designs on merchandise at antiupmagazine.com/shop. You can buy t-shirts, hoodies, sweatshirts, phone and laptop cases, coffee and drink mugs, and more with your choice of Antiup Magazine, Antiup PokerCast, or Antiup Poker Tour logos. Hey, you know, I'm always seeing this stuff online. People always comment and saying, hey, if you're going to go to the restaurant or you're going to order, make sure you tip them really big because, they're not making a lot of money and showing your appreciation. Well, you know, hey! Scott and I can really use you buying a couple of shirts here and there, you know what I'm saying? So I want to eat something this week, so of course I'm just kidding. If you have a hand of the week, listener spotlight, or call the floor submission, email us at podcast@antiupmagazine.com or post in the Antiup Fans group on Facebook. And we need them, right? We need some stuff, man. We need some.
Yeah, we definitely need some stuff, as you'll know as we get through the rest of the show. Although I will say we had two or three submissions come in last night, so the cupboard is not as bare as what's that lady in the fairy tale?
Mother Hubbard.
Yep. but it is pretty fair.
Okay, well, we do have a call to four. This is good, and somebody's harking back to their vacationing days, so that's really good. But if you do find yourself in a situation at your favorite poker room or home game and you're not sure what that ruling should have been, email us at podcast@antiupmagazine.com. We'll have Hollywood Casino Toledo Director of Poker Elliot Schechter tell you how you would have ruled. This week's prize is a 30-minute telephone lesson and workbook from Thomas Gallagher Casino Seminars, specializing in poker odds and math at poker911.net. Comes from Brandon Huff. This occurred when I was vacationing in Aruba. I got a seat in a 2-5 must-move game in the poker room. After a short while, I was moved to the main table. I checked in on my wife, who was playing slots. I played a little longer at the main table, went to check in on her again, and she was wiped, ready to crash. I've been playing just over an hour. I racked up and go to cash out when the floor pulls me aside. He tells me the other players wanted him to tell me that it was customary to stay at least 2 hours at the game. Not knowing what else to do, I apologized to the table as a whole. I said, just arrived today, I was wiped out, and that I had to leave now, but I'd be back another night and definitely would stay more than 2 hours. True to my word, I did, and I stayed longer, though many of them may have regretted it. Have you ever heard of anything like this? Is this an unspoken rule? Old unspoken rule? Was I just being toyed with? I doubt this is enforceable in any way and does not seem like a customer-friendly attitude.
All right, Elliot says, variations of this rule are common in private games in South Florida. Before poker was fully legalized in the mid-2000s, the four-hour rule was in effect at almost every game, or so I've heard. This rule made it quite clear that anyone who took a seat in one of those games must play at least 4 hours prior to being allowed to cash out. Losers could cash out at any time, of course. Most of the players that left early were generally not given seats at the start of games on future evenings. They could only wait for a seat after a game had already started. This rule was nicknamed for a player that was notorious for cashing out exactly after 4 hours, even if they were up only one chip. But when losing any amount, would stay until the sun came up the next day. The reason this rule was in effect was because almost every private game operator had only one table, and seats that opened were generally not able to be filled, especially in the offseason. The players that started were usually the players that finished. Someone leaving early, especially if they were a big winner, was very damaging, as that game would break earlier due to the combination of the decreased action caused by having less than a full table and the lesser amount of money in play. Aruba being such a small locale to have a regular poker game, the same dynamics are in play. A small group of available players, limited seats at one or two tables in the big game, players probably not making a visit if they're not guaranteed a seat. This necessitates players being quote-unquote advised to play a certain amount of time to protect the game and the players. Any rules enforceable, casinos are willing to dole out the penalties to violators, but this particular rule is almost always, it's almost never seen in casino poker. I don't think you were being misled or played. They have seats that are probably very hard to keep filled after they come open. As you stated, this rule can seem player unfriendly, and a casino is smart enough to not make it an official. Although, if you pull the players that are victimized by hit and run winners, this perspective can change in a hurry. This is why most casinos mandate that players coming back to the same game within 2 hours of their leaving must return with all the money with which they left, rather than set a minimum time of play. From an operator's point of view, making someone play a minimum amount of time at a poker table would prevent newly solvent poker players from trying their luck at the various exciting offerings on the casino floor. And I'll add for Elliot, the more lucrative exciting offering on the casino floor. While I'm not a proponent of this rule, I can understand its use in poker rooms that have small player bases.
Yeah, I mean, really, who goes to Aruba to play poker unless it's part of the WPT stop they used to have there? So, I mean, seriously, if you are going to go sit down on a table, you know, you probably are going to be the only one in that seat the whole night, you know. And so if you do leave, but he's absolutely right. There is no way it's enforceable. Of course, if you won't get invited back to private games that are
The way it's enforceable.
Yeah, but you can't do that in a casino. So,
but even a casino, they could say, hey, all right, you can leave right now, but don't bother coming back.
Yeah, right.
Today, tomorrow, next week, right? So that's how you enforce it. You can't, I don't think you can lock somebody in a table and make them play. And even if you could, I mean, you know how players would be then. They would just fold everything,
just fold everything, yeah, exactly.
So really, you can't mandate action in a game, right? You do incentives in the game to get people to give action, right? But you can't mandate it. So what I think was interesting about this, and what I told Brennan, was that there's a must move in this room, because he was in the I don't know if I left that in the letter or not, if I edited it out, but he was in a must move. I guess it was at the beginning.
I read it. He was in the must move.
So generally, you know, when you have a must move, it's because they want to protect that big game. They want to make sure that main game is going. Right. So, you know, they force players into that game, so that game is always full, and then the feeder games are the ones that have to suffer. But you know, if it was it, so, I think from a player perspective, let's say I'm in the must move table for 4 hours, right? Because nobody in the main game is leaving, right?
Yeah.
And then somebody leaves, and I'm first up, and, you know, you don't get the option of staying at the feeder table. You have to go to the main game or leave, right? Those are your two options.
Right.
So if I knew I had played 4 hours and I was only going to want to play 6 hours the entire day, or I'm just not feeling it, or, you know, all the kind of things you can make decisions, right? So now I know my options are I have to get up and commit to another 4 hours at the main game or leave. I'm going to leave, right? So now, obviously, the next person on the list will probably want to jump into the game. That's why the mess move works. But imagine a scenario if that game is the feeder game is six-handed now. And if it's a small room like this where they do the must move to protect the game, that's not an unlikely scenario, right? So you were first up, and now you say, hey, I can't commit to 4 hours. I'm out. So now that game is five-handed, but they need to take somebody from that game to the main game. So they take the next person who is willing to go. So the main game's full, and now that feeder game is four-handed and breaks up, right?
Yeah.
And then so another hour or so, some people in the main game decide they're ready to go, and then that game breaks. So, you know, I get why the players want it in this game for whatever reason, but I think if you play it out the long way, it actually is detrimental to the whole purpose that they have for the rule.
I've never liked Must Move. I just never have. And you know what's funny is that all the years that we've played and all the years that we've traveled all around the country, I've only been, in one, I think. I think it was one game, it was in Mississippi.
Wow, really? Only one Must Move game? Wow.
Yeah. I've avoided them at not at all costs, but it just seems like most of the time I'm playing a 1-2 game or something where there's dozens of them and I'm not, there's no reason for it. But every once in a while there was one that they say, well, that's a Must Move. You want to play, you got it. I'm like, is it something else? And they're like, well, we got 2-5 or whatever it is. And then I would probably play something else because I always like, I put in all this time at the table I'm in. Like you said, if you're there for 4 hours, you've learned all the habits of these people, you've learned the flow, you've learned the average raise, all that stuff. And then they're like, okay, now go play in another table because we want to keep them all happy and keep that game going.
Well, in that main game, usually you're walking into people with bigger stacks.
Huge stacks, exactly. So I've always avoided it. But there was one time, it was definitely, it might have been Harrah's in Mississippi. It might have been Tunica. But I can't remember for sure. And it was Must Move, and I got moved. And I don't remember if I did well or not. I think I might have broken even or whatever. But I remember coming away from it going, that sucked, you know. But anyway, you make a great point. It's why I keep you on. You know.
Yeah, no, I played a lot of Must Moves. I'm with you. I prefer not to. I'm not a big fan of the concept. I understand why it's there, but as a player, I just really don't like it for that same reason, because I get comfortable and then I get picked up and I have to move to another game. What I always think is funny, though, is how long it takes you at the main game before the main game is the feeder game you started out with, right?
Right.
You know, how long it is, how quickly people cycle out. And sometimes a half an hour after you get moved to the main game, enough players have left that you're playing the same game you were half an hour ago with the same people, right? So that's kind of cool when it works out. But it doesn't usually work out that way. Usually the people in that main game have been there forever and are staying there until they die. So, it's one of those things that we talk about. I think last week we had some stuff, and small rooms have to do different things to protect the game. Poker is not like blackjack. You know, blackjack, you have one player and a dealer. That's all you need. Yeah. Poker, you know, as we said at the top of the show, you know, you need at least two players and a dealer, and to have a real game in most places, you need to have six players. So
yeah.
You're a small room or a locale that doesn't have a lot of poker players, you have to do some of this stuff to make sure you can keep that game going. So,
and that was a thing, too. It was like there was like 7 or 8 tables that night, and it just seemed so odd to me. And they were all 1-2.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, okay, you know, it just doesn't make any sense. You know, if you go, maybe you have a rule in the room that says, if we get down to 2 tables, one will be designated a must move or something.
I've seen that some places. Yeah, you're right.
Right? But other than that, that's what was so weird about that night, was there were so many tables to choose from, and it was must move. And I just sat down because it was the first seat that came up, and I think you were already playing like limit somewhere or something. And I'm just sitting there, and I'm like, screw it, I'll play. But I didn't want to. And then I got moved. It was crazy. So anyway, we have a new O'Malley's move. Here it comes.
Hello, and welcome to another O'Malley's Move. I'm Malcolm O'Malley. This week we are playing $1, $2, No Limit Hold'em at our regular casino cash game. We've been playing for roughly 3 hours and have doubled up to 400. The game is 9-handed. The blinds post, the under the gun, and plus one fold, and we're in the MP with the ace of diamonds, king of diamonds. I want to bet enough to get to a heads-up situation. We make it $15 to go. It gets folded around to the button, who calls. The button seems to be a decent player. He's been here for about an hour, and hasn't done anything too crazy. He bought in for 200 as well, and currently has 500. We've only seen him show down 2 hands. One was ace-queen that he flopped a flush draw with and turned a straight, taking an opponent's stack on the river. The second was when his 10s filled up against a flush on a 4-spade board. The blinds fold, and with $30 in the pot, the flop is the king of hearts, 7 of clubs, 4 of diamonds. This is a really good flop for our hand. We have top-top on a safe board and a backdoor flush draw. We decide to lead out, definitely wanting a call. We make it $20 to go. Our opponent quickly puts in the $20. There's now $70 in the pot, and the turn is the 4 of spades. I think we'd like to get some value. We make it $40 to go. Our opponent calls after a slight hesitation. There's now $150 in the pot, and the river is the jack of spades. We count out a nice even 100 and slide it into the pot. Our opponent asks for a count. We tell him we have 225 left. He announces all in. So, we've got kings and fours with an ace kicker. This board isn't entirely scary. What's the move?
All right, it's time for the AdvancedPokerTraining.com Hand of the Week. Send your hands or situations to podcast at AntiUpMagazine.com, please. If you haven't won something from us in the past year, you'll get a free membership to Advanced Poker Trading, the world's number one poker training site. Okay, Chris, so here's the deal. For the longest time, I mean, people can kind of notice on the show that we don't always do the listener spotlight of the call floor.
Yeah.
And it's not because we don't want to do it, it's because we don't have any of them, right? So, but you know, we have a bunch of other stuff on the show, so we kind of trust that you won't notice that we skipped over that, right? But we've always had a hand of the week, and so even when we got kind of towards the bottom of the barrel, we had about 60 hands from Vic G, right?
Yeah, right.
And so then we started to blow through those, and we exhausted them a couple weeks ago. But I always knew. I had this this listener that we haven't heard from in years, but at one point she sent me a Dropbox link of almost every hand of online poker she's ever played. And it's funny because I checked the email this week, and she said, I'm tired of you guys begging for hands of the week. Here's every hand I've ever played. And I'm like, oh, that's funny. So I'm back in the same situation I was then. So I click on it, and the Dropbox files aren't there anymore.
Oh.
Jeez. So both our main shoot and our lollipop shoot did not deploy this week. And like I said, we have had a couple of people send hands last night, so we'll probably be good for another week or two. But please send your hands so we don't have to be as creative as we are tonight. But I kind of like how creative I got.
Yeah, okay. Well, just don't do it with Cincinnati Kid or I'm going to leave the show definitely.
So I thought, you know, all right, so we don't have a hand of the week. We can't just end the show without a hand of the week because people are going to notice that, right?
Yeah.
So then I thought, you know, we talked about going back and doing old hands, but I don't really have those files anymore. You know, I thought maybe we could go old school. When we started the show, we didn't have listener hands, right? We analyzed hands on the WPT broadcast, which was even more hilarious than it sounds because the two of us who knew absolutely nothing about poker then.
We knew enough.
We're somehow analyzing people that made their living off of playing, right?
Yeah.
So I'm like, I could do that. But then, you know, I've been kind of doing this bond thing. I didn't really commit to it as much as I thought I would. And everybody talks about the famous hand in the 2006 James Bond movie Casino Royale, right, and how ridiculous it is. So I thought it might be fun for us to take a fictional hand and analyze it like hand of the week until we get real hands again.
Okay.
Now, I thought about the James Bond one. I thought about some hands from Rounders, what we could do. Uh-huh. I mean, obviously, Cincinnati Kid was on the list, but apparently I have to scratch that off. But,
well, if we're truly desperate.
Scratching that right off the list right now. But I'm like, you know what? I actually have not seen, obviously I have not seen this Casino Royale movie. I had not seen The Hand. I've heard all the discussion about it, so I knew how it ended, right? But so, unfortunately, YouTube had the clip of The Hand, so I watched it. And so we are going to do our best to analyze the pivotal poker hand in the 2006 movie Casino Royale today.
Okay, this sounds haphazard. All right, go ahead.
All right. Well, it is haphazard because one is Hollywood,
yes,
so
yes.
There's some Hollywood license involved here. It's not as bad as some other ones, but I think as we get into this, we will see where they could have made it a little bit more believable, right?
Yeah.
All right. So, admittedly, we don't have all the information because they started out right away with the flop, so we don't know what the pre-flop action was. And then we don't really know what the action was on the flop. So, really, all the action that we've seen is on the turn in the river. So, what we can tell you, though, is pre-flop, the big blind was 1 million. Presumably, the small blind was 500,000, right?
Right.
So, that's what we know. The game is four-handed. Now, I haven't seen the movie. Have you? You've seen the movie, right?
I've seen the movie.
Okay. So, I don't know if there's any more information about these four players that I to me, they're just James Bond and three other people, but
Right. It's, one of them is the villain that he's trying to... I assume the villain has a backstory,
but did the other two...
The other guys are just like random players that they... Okay. I think they may have seen him during the week at the casino or whatever, but basically the main guy is the villain that you're going to talk about.
Okay. All right. So, so we know the big blind was $1 million. It's four-handed. The flop was the ace of hearts, eight of spades, six of spades. Again, we don't know what the action was, but there was a whisper from a guy in the crowd that the pot was now $24 million, right?
Okay.
So, with four-handed, that means each player has committed $6 million to the hand at this point, either pre-flop or after the flop.
Right. So, the big blind was $1 million. So, the small blind was $500,000. Somebody had to have probably raised to $6 million, and they all called. Or it was something like someone raised to $3 million, and someone re-raised to $6 million, and they all called. But one way or another, somebody made a raise here.
$3 million pre-flop, and then a bet of $3 million on the flop that everybody called.
Oh, it was after the flop. I forget. Okay, $24 million was after the flop. Okay, yeah, so exactly. Someone raised to 3, which would be perfect. It'd be 3X. Everyone calls the 3X. Then the flop comes, and someone bets $3 million. And they all called. Okay, so that's what it seems like. Okay.
It could have been any of those scenarios, right? So all right. We know is that every player has committed $6 million
gotcha.
By the end of the flop.
All right, very good.
Okay, so now we can pick up the action with the turn card, which was the four of spades. And because this is a very exciting hand, it checks around. I don't know why they cut out the action on the pre-flop and the flop where there's actually stuff going on just to show us.
Nothing going on. quality. And I remember reading about this, too, in the past, where they actually had advisors on set, or when they were at least writing the scene, telling them, you know, what to do. And then how do they not say, hey, that was pretty boring. Let's go back to at least the exciting raise and look at all the whole card, you know, or something. But no, they just filmed the check around. That's hilarious.
Because you could have done all this action quicker. Right, I mean it's a movie, right?
Yeah,
it's not like, you know, you need to have somebody think and contemplate pre-flop and make this out. In fact, this whole scene was 4 minutes, but by the time we got to the river, we were only 30 seconds into the scene, which was hilarious. But. all right, so anyhow, so our board now is the ace of hearts, eight of spades, six of spades, four of spades, and now the river comes the ace of spades.
Right.
Is that correct? Sure.
Yeah, because I fixed your thing there. You had the ace of spades, king of spades for player A, but he actually had the king of spades, queen of spades.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's right, yes.
Yeah,
but
so I fixed
there are four spades on the board. All right.
I fixed that for you.
Yeah, I figured that. I just didn't realize there were four spades.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, so anyhow, the villain in our hand checks. James Bond also checks. And then player A, I mean, I could have came up with fake names for him, but let's just play player A because that's really popular hands of the week, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So player A moves all in for $6 million.
Right.
Player B calls all in for less, which is $5 million. And he gets back to the villain who raises to $12 million. And then James Bond moves all in for $40.5 million. I don't know why they had to throw the extra $500,000 in there, but
that's what he had.
And then after some very quick contemplation, the villain calls. So it's really a situation of the week is what we've come down to, right?
Right.
All right. So so then they do a showdown, and they're very orderly in this casino. And they do it out of order, too, by the way. Did you notice that?
I did notice because Bond was supposed to call show first because he made the last big bet and got called. So he's supposed to show first, but he didn't.
And even if you do it in order of the button, it didn't work.
Right,
so
right.
I mean, presumably the player with the least amount of money, the player with the $5 million was the button because the action seemed to always, well, the one time we saw action start, it was on the villain, right? So he wasn't asked to show down. Plus you have multiple side pots here, right?
Yep.
And you should settle the main pot before you do the side pots, right? So really it should have been James Bond, the villain, that showed first. But that didn't happen. So the guy who initially moved in turns over the king of spades, queen of spades, and they're fixing that. It got confusing because they messed with the board, which would really piss me off if I was in that casino. But anyhow.
Yeah.
All right. So player A, he's the one that moved all in on the river. He shows the king of spades, queen of spades for the non-nut flush.
Yeah. Well, for a guy who's playing for 20 million or whatever in his hand, he doesn't know that. You know, you don't shove with king of spades, queen of spades there when a paired board and a straight flush possible. But whatever.
Yeah. Okay, so then the other player, the next player had, who called for less, had a set of eights.
So full house.
That's what I was trying to figure out. Where is the full? Oh, yeah, because of the aces.
He appeared the ace on the end, so he's got eights full of aces.
Eights full of aces for the full house. Our villain tables ace six offsuit. Horrible hand, by the way, but it's four-handed. Right? For a better boat. And then, of course, James Bond, because, you know, James Bond always gets what he wants, tables the five of spades, seven of spades for the straight flush.
The straight flush.
Okay.
So we're gonna revisit how this all happened.
Well, it's a situation, so I think we need to talk about how each player played the hand here. So
I got to tell you, the king of spades, queen of spades is the only one that is really that shocking in this. Not the spoiler alert, but really, if you're playing four-handed, ace six is fine to play. Especially if you're in position, you know what I mean, and you're all playing because you're playing the people, not the cards, which I'm sure they mentioned in the movie at some point. Bond 5-7, you know, one gapper suited. You know, you're trying to bust this guy. How are you going to bust somebody without? It's got to be a shocking hand. So I can see him calling a raise, especially
40 big ones too.
Yeah, there's a lot of money in the middle, and he's got 50 million in front of him. So I'm sure he can handle calling a 3 million raise preflop. King of spades, queen of spades. All right, it's a trap hand, but four-handed, it's pretty powerful. So I can see that guy making the raise pre-flop or calling the raise if that wasn't what it was. And then pocket eight, set mine in four-handed. That's I mean, even that's a raising hand. So he could have been the one to raise with it anyway. So pre-flop, I don't mind all these hands being in the middle with a minor small raise. Granted, it's millions, and that's what makes this entire thing hilarious, that the blinds are 500 or a million. But anyway, so preflop, right? I have no problem with how anybody played this hand.
Well, here's one. We don't know exactly how they played a preflop.
Right,
which
but I mean, that they're in the hand, I mean.
However, though, what we do know as we deconstruct this hand is that the player with the king of spades, queen of spades, who was presumably in the small blind, had 12 million to start this hand.
Okay.
Okay. Yep. So, again, our danger zone is 10 million, right? Now, of course, this is a cash game right now, a tournament. So, you don't have to feel like you need to shove at some point, right? But generally, if you think about it from a tournament perspective, at 12 big blinds there, if you're going to get involved in this hand, you would probably shove, would you not?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a four-handed cash game, though, so we're not doing that.
Okay, I'm just saying, but that's what you would do. So.
Yeah, in a tournament, yeah, you'd probably be shoving.
At the very least, he had to complete the big blind preflop.
Right.
Of 500,000 to get to the million. And then presumably had to put, if that scenario is correct, had to put 5 million in on the flop.
Right, if it was unraised.
Flush draw.
Right, and then after the flop. But then, yeah, the flush draw, I think he's the one that's suspect in this hand, this king-queen guy.
Suspect all the way through,
all the way through, right. I mean, if it's just calling pre-flop, yeah, I think you probably are emboldened to raise there if it wasn't raised pre-flop. If it was raised pre-flop, then I don't have a problem with him just calling in a cash game. I don't think anyone's shoving in a cash game when they have 12 million in front of them and blinds are 5 and 1. They have 12 big blinds. I don't think they're shoving. The reason you shove in a tournament is because you got to stay alive for another round, and it's going up. This is never going up, and this is what he's – I don't think that's a problem. But
you also have limited bullets here, right? So, and then the other wrinkle here is they did mention at the beginning of the hand that you could not buy in again.
Yeah. So it's a
I don't know
up.
Why that just –
freeze up cash game.
Yeah, at this point that they got to a point where you can't buy in anymore. So – Hollywood's trying to make us think that this is a tournament without making it a tournament, which would make it a lot more.
Yeah.
Although, there were chips, though. I mean, I didn't watch the whole movie. Was this a cash game? I mean, maybe it was a tournament.
No, it was a cash game because he had to get the money from the guy. I mean, unless there was a prize fund at the end, but I don't think it was. I think he needed to get all the money from the guy in the game.
I mean, that was
right?
my assumption. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think it is a cash game.
Okay. All right. So, So, yeah, that guy's suspect, right? I also think the 8-8 player, who presumably was the big blind here, played this kind of weird, too.
Depending on the action. We don't know what the action is.
I agree. But, let's say if the action was there was no aggressive action pre-flop.
Right.
Then it's less suspect, I think. Because at that point, he's just checking and set mining, as you mentioned, right? However, there was a raise pre-flop. That means he would have to have called with this with only 11 big blinds.
Well, he could have been the one who raised, too, though. Could have been call, call, call. Now I make it $3
million. Right. So if he's the one raising, would you not, again, I know
shove.
It's not, well, why would you not shove? I mean, you're still going to pick up, presumably at that point, well, you would pick up, I mean, everybody was in for
it'd
something.
It'd be $3 million. You'd pick up.
At that point, it would $3 be $3 million, million, which is a pretty big bump to your.
$8, $9 million, $10 million stack, yeah.
With a hand that's really vulnerable on a flop, even four-handed, right?
Yeah, yeah. So then if someone else raised, he should have shoved, you think, too? You think he's going to race with 8-8 against somebody for.
I think the way that. We obviously know that there were four players in pre-flop, right?
Right.
So the best case scenario for the 8-8 hand was that. Our villain limped for a million, James Bond limped for a million, our small blind called, and that was the best case scenario, right?
Yeah.
And so at that point, if that happened, then he could have just checked and given up the opportunity to really put pressure on somebody to pick up, you know, increase the stack by almost 30%.
Yeah.
Now, if they raised at any point, then absolutely, I think he made a huge mistake by not just shoving.
I just don't know. I when I play cash, I'm looking to make sure I'm going to make the most amount of money for this hand that I can. And when I'm looking to, if I can hit a set and have somebody who raised before or just came along and called hit the top pair, you know what I mean? I just don't think of shoving in cash games ever.
Right.
I mean, I just don't. Now, of course, you did say you can't rebuy, so the guy might be saying, I can't compete with these guys until I get more money. But we don't know what he bought in for. We don't know how much he started with. He could be up a bunch and playing this way. So, I mean, there's a lot of backstory we're missing. But you like to turn it into a tournament, and I don't know if that's necessarily what I would have done. In a tournament, yeah, I'm shoving because it's a high optimal play there. But in this case, I feel like, all right, I got a guy with $40 million on my left. I got another guy who's got that much almost on my left. And I got pocket eights here. They could be trapping me. It's only four hand. You know what I mean? So let me at least see the flop.
Are you talking the scenario where everybody's calling here? Or are you?
Yeah,
talking,
I'm thinking the calling.
Raise.
And okay. I'm not raising. Or I'm thinking I'm raising, but I'm not shoving because it's too much to shove.
I guess what I'm saying is your scenario where the big blind is able to check?
Yeah, I think both scenarios. I think I can see this guy getting to the turn the way he did without committing that big of a faux pas in this game. But
well, I would definitely argue that if the action pre-flop was calls and all he had to do was check, and then he flops a set and he just calls at that point as a trap, that makes sense to me.
Right.
But if there was a raise pre-flop, this does not make sense to me. At that point, I think if you're going to play eights there, you got to play it for a raise, and the only legitimate raise would be all in.
I like to do this to you. Let's pretend it's me, you, Gambit, and Faso. All right.
Which one of us is James Bond?
Right.
Of course, right?
Clearly you, right? Because you like to drink. But you don't drink gin. So, all right. So we're four-handed in a cash game because everyone else busted out because we take all their money all the time. So now, all right. It goes to you. Now, we're in our regular game, so let's say we're playing 1-2 Skittles, and we all bought in for 100, and you're down to, say, $50, and we all have 150 to 200 in front of us.
Okay.
And you're on the big blind, and Gambit raises, I call, Faso calls. You really think you're shoving $50 in the middle after we went from
to win 40?
1-2 to 6? No, because it's not. It went to 6, so it's 24.
Like,
so you're betting
absolutely
50 to win 24.
Well, it depends on the raise.
Not even, $18.
Bucks.
You're not going to, I don't think you're going to, you might re-raise. I don't know if you're going to shove for $18, risk 50, when there's three of us who have you well covered.
The scenario is different than this. Why don't we use this scenario? The scenario is 11 big blinds. So however you want to do it. So
all right, well, okay.
Playing 1-2, so that means I have $22.
$22. Yeah.
And just for giggles, let's say that Gambit raises it to 6, like 3x raise, which you wouldn't normally do, right?
Right.
So, and you guys all call, so now that's 18 in the middle plus my $2 big blind, so 20 in the middle, and I've got $22 left.
But you know if you shove, you're going to get called, no matter what, and you're going to be racing against 6 cards, because no one's going to fold for that when they have 200 in front of them. So at that point, you're racing 6 cards instead of seeing a flop for minimal or nothing if they didn't raise pre-flop. And you, so that's the other thing.
I'm also sure they're all going to come along.
Okay,
there,
so
that's an interesting point. That's a good.
I think they would for $10 or $20. Well, $20. All right, so $20. We have 200 in front of us, and we all played for a raise already.
Actually, technically, I'd only have 20 at that point if we were in the same scenario, because I would have had to put my blind.
Put your blind in. So really, for $20, when we have 200 in front of us, and it's a chance to embarrass you in front of everyone, yeah, we're going to take that shot. I think at least 2 people are going to call. $20 in a pot that now has 20 plus this 18, 38. So basically they're getting 2-1 on their money pre-flop, knowing that they have a chance to knock you out, make you go to your dresser to get more money, right? Or whatever. So I think there
good to
might
know that
be
you, your money in your dresser.
A little voice in the back of your head might say, all right, I'm just going to call, or I'm just going to check, depending
right
on what happens.
Well, check. Again, this whole scenario changes whether whether I or this guy is checking or whether
right,
he's calling
right,
the rates,
right?
Right. Again, checking, that's fine. I see that. I can see that all day long. But if I'm sitting there with $20 in your scenario left in my stack, have a $2 big blind in there, and it's been raised to 6 and everybody's called, I think it's a little harder now to commit that extra 4 of my 20 left. That's 25% of my stack.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
On
so
a
you're
hand,
taking
that's going to be four-handed regardless. I mean, the only chance I have for it not to be four-handed is race. I mean, there's a possibility that one or two of you might drop out, but you're right. I mean, maybe nobody does. But I know if I check, or if I just call that $6 raise, I am battling 6 cards.
Okay, so then are we trying to surmise that we think it was a check around? Like it was a call, limp, limp, limp,
no,
check?
No, we don't know. There's definitely a scenario. I think what we're doing is discussing the difference of whether there was a raise preflop or not.
Because that's plausible then.
Just the whole action, right?
Right. It's plausible if it was just check preflop or limped, I mean. Because then he's like, all right, I'll check because I've got a decent hand, but they might be trapping me, whatever, so I'm going to check here. And then if it comes all unders, I'm shoving. I'm doing a stop-and-go kind of thing. And so that's what could have happened. If it's the other way, I kind of agree with you. If it went the villain in this hand raised, bond calls, small blind calls, and it gets back to our guy with pocket eights and he's got to risk 25% of his stack to call when he could just shove and with 11 big blinds.
Because he started at 11. He has one big blind in because he's the big blind too.
Right.
So, yeah, that's what I'm saying. If it was limp, preflop, absolutely. I can see you checking there.
So that's what we're gonna try to figure out what happened. We're trying to figure out the preflop action. I think we did. I think that's what it did. I think the villain raised. I mean, villain limped.
To give this player credit, I'm gonna say it was a limp around, right?
Yeah, because I would limp with A6 maybe and four-handed. I don't know.
And that even gives some credit to the small blind with his king of spades, queen of spades, because that would be a hand even kind of short-handed that I would probably call the 500 if I felt pretty confident the big blind wasn't going to raise me.
Right. So there you go.
Queen suited is better than it is nine-handed, right?
So we're positive. We've figured this out. We're positive that it was a limp around check scenario. Yeah, it's getting easier now.
Okay, all right. So, all right, now that we've agreed with that, that means on this flop of ace of hearts, eight of spades, six of spades, there was some combination of bets that resulted in $5 million from each player getting in.
Okay, so I'm going to think that
there's probably going to be one bet and everybody called.
Right, and I don't think the king of queen bet out yet.
No, there's no way.
And I know the 8-8 didn't.
Right.
And the 8-6 probably didn't. He's got aces up. He probably doesn't want to. Well, he might. He might want to protect.
He's more vulnerable in the set. He is the one that makes the most sense because everybody else is either drawing. Well, the two players are drawing, and the other player has a set who, and shorthanded, is going to be willing to risk the spade coming. Not that the spade was going to come. Oh, the spade totally came twice. But
so here's so what it is.
It has to be our villain in the hand that bet $5 million into the $4 million pot.
Or he could have bet $2.5 million, and then James Bond, being in position with an open-ended straight flush draw, said, "I'll min-raise you," and they all called.
Okay.
So he went 2.5, I min-raised to 5, call, we're going to the turn with 24 million.
I think you're a little bit into Hollywood here, Chris.
I'm trying to make it more exciting. We're only an hour and 10 minutes into this show. Might as well make a two-hour show out of it.
You didn't think we were going to be able to talk this long about a fake hand, but look at this right now. But there's no plausible scenario now that makes sense in this situation because, one, it doesn't make sense to overbet the pot here, even with top pair, bottom pair.
Yeah.
And that's what we're suggesting happened, right? We're suggesting that he bet $5 million into a $4 million pot.
Yeah.
I suppose you could.
I mean, his name is
the other scenario that we're talking about is $2.5 million with a min raise, which doesn't seem to make sense to anyone, to me.
Well, he is French, so he likes PLO. So he may have just bet pot automatically because that's basically what you do. No, I don't know. I have no idea.
Okay, but it's probably more likely that that's how the action went, right? That it was limped around preflop, a $5 million bet from our ace six two right. pair guy.
Right.
Trying to protect his or make somebody make a bad decision, right?
Right.
And then Bond obviously is going to call because he's deep and has the open end straight flush draw.
Right.
The other guy, this is where the king, queen, spade guy would have made a mistake. Is at that point, if you're going to call that extra $5 million here and leave $6 million behind, you should probably raise, I think.
You probably just shove and get it in there.
Yep. Or fold. I mean, I can't imagine you folding, but I mean, if you're gonna stick in here, I think you shove.
Yeah. Well, the other thing too is, I think they might. You know what they might be doing too is they might be trying to cater to there are fish to table, and people like to keep as many people in the hands when they're fish, and so he might be saying, I'm just gonna call because I'm gonna make this huge flush, and everyone's gonna stay in the same. I'm not gonna scare anybody out by shoving. See, we're playing optimally, we think. For two idiots online.
But there's two reasons you make that shove there. One is in case the spade doesn't come, right? So you want to cash in now. That's one reason. The other reason is to make the call and hope you get the spade. And as you mentioned, that people aren't going to be concerned because it's four-handed.
Yeah, I think you're thinking way too sophisticated for this first player. I think he's just some billionaire who sat down at a table and said, I'm trying to figure out a player.
We're playing for $124 million here. I'm giving it a threat, I guess.
But yeah, I could see him saying, oh, screw it. If I got to call half my stack for this, I got the second nut flush draw I'm going to shove. In his mind, second nut flush draw, not knowing that straight flush is out there.
The big blind would have had to do that, too. He's sitting for less. He's got $5 million, and he's got a set. And he's got all these people already involved.
And he wants to protect his hand.
I see you slow playing that, but now that people are betting, there's no reason to slow play now.
Yeah.
You're only losing the one hand here.
Plus, you want to protect your hand against the flush a little bit, and it seems like you got people involved, so you're going to double up no matter what.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you're not going to fold this at any point, right? You might as well do it now rather than when that spade or straight gets there on the turn.
Yeah. 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 So they played it terribly after the flop no matter what.
But, now turn comes. All right, so it starts with our guy with A6, and now he's like, "Oh, great, flush got there." And
the turn comes. The first player would be the king queen because he's a small blind. Starts with king queen.
Interesting, because.
So why would the villain?
Oh, so check? Maybe we're wrong on this because in the river it was the villain, the A6 that checked first. So.
Oh, so there you go. So now we got the blinds all wrong. So now we just screwed up for half an hour for nothing. This is a great show, Scott. This is why we don't use Hollywood hands. This is why we don't do this. Please send us hands of the week or the show is going down the crapper.
Hey, it was still a good discussion, even if it was a fake discussion about a fake hand.
Oh, man.
All right, so real quickly. So then that means that Bond was the big blind, so the first player to limp in would have been the king of spades, queen of spades. That does not make sense now.
All right.
Now, the eights acting next, limping in, that does make sense. And then our A6 guy completing makes sense. And then, of course, Bond not wanting to raise with this crappy 5-7 makes sense.
Right. It still could have been the... So and then it could have been the raises, right, then the check around. Now we got to... I got to go to the bathroom, man. I can't go over through this whole thing all over again. Oh, man, we're 72 minutes into this show. We can't redo this hand. Oh, man.
All right, so regardless, so now we're on the turn, though. So now the villain slows down, right? Because
yeah.
A spade got there, and presumably a straight got there.
Right.
Bond, of course, has the mortal nuts, so he's not going anywhere. He's not going to bet, right? And then Player A, of course, got his flush, and now he has to move in for his $6 million. And then Player B at this point, that's what's kind of confusing now. I mean, at this point, he's decided that he's pot committed. I don't know why he didn't think he was pot committed earlier in his hand, because he was. So he just calls.
Well, the turn was a check around, so nobody bet the turn.
Well, that's right, yeah.
In the movie. So, but that's what should have happened.
Right.
Right, it should have been, okay, the A6, although the A6 might still bet, he still got top and middle pair, and he can't believe four-handed that not only one but two flushes are out there and a set. So he probably does bet in real life there, and then Bond would just call in real life, and then the king-queen might now shove.
Right.
And then the 8-8 would call, and then the A6 might even fold at that point. Who knows? And then the 7-5 calls and it's all over.
Yeah, depending on how the action works, yeah.
Yeah.
You might decide, hey, oh my God, there is one of these flushes out there, if not two,
yeah,
or more.
Yeah, or straight, and there you go. So, yeah, this is bizarre. Oh, man, we screwed this up royally. This is why you listen to our show.
Look at that. We screwed it up royally.
Casino royally.
It was all planned. It was all planned.
Oh, man.
All right, well, it was worth the effort. It was fun.
It was fun, and the river made the rest of it all moot anyway, so... All right, please, send us Hand of the Week and buy a t-shirt. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
We'll see you at the tables.
Ante Up is a production of AnteUpMagazine.com. Contact the show at podcast@AnteUpMagazine.com or call our hotline at 206-338-6344. If you'd like to advertise, send an email to advertising@AnteUpMagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.